Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. In this episode, I'm talking to Professor Dave Beer, who's a professor of sociology at the University of York, about his new book, The Data Gaze, which was published by Sage in 2019. So welcome back to the podcast.
Hello. Hello, Dave. Thanks for having me back.
This is a really well-timed book, given that both, you know, broadly we're engaging with these kind of questions of data, and then seemingly kind of like every single day there's a new question about data-related issues.
Yeah.
But this isn't, I guess, a kind of a new topic for you. We talked before, and I guess this is probably the third kind of like data-themed book you've written, a different angle. And I guess that the place to start is, like, why do you find this kind of such a rich and sort of rewarding area to be working on?
Yeah, you're right. No, this is the third book. I think it was about somewhere around like 2009-ish, 2010, I think I'd done a piece about algorithms, and I was thinking about the role of data, or that the way that the kind of media infrastructures were increasingly running on data. And at that time, I thought, well, one of the interesting thing is how, is not just how, because there's a lot of stuff about data being mined and data being harvested, data being extracted, this kind of thing. And I sort of, it's a simple observation, really. I sort of thought, well, what's interesting is when those data circulate back into the social world and change things. So I started to think, well, how can you understand those data circulations? How can you understand how data folding back in to the world changes and transforms what's going on? So that was what led. I then wrote the book, Popular Culture, New Media, Politics, Circulation, which we spoke about at the time. And that was an attempt to think what happens when data falls back into culture. And then that opened up questions for me. I sort of thought, well, this also suggests a sort of series of political questions about about the relationship between data and power. So I picked those up, and that was the worked on the book Metric Power. And then I'd still got questions left about how the data circulations were mediated and who was involved in their mediation. And that led me to write The Data Gaze. So It sounds a bit grand, but it was intended as to be a little sort of like a trilogy. I remember William Mitchell once using this phrase to describe three of his books as a kind of loose trilogy, which I was sort of quite like the idea of that. So it wasn't intended to start off with, but it ended up like that as three books that are about different aspects of data circulations: one about culture, one about politics and power, and one about mediation and intermediaries.
I mean, the really sort of obvious thing is what is this data gaze then? What's this, you know, kind of big idea in this book?
Yeah. So, it seems to me that, like, the social world is being reconfigured around data, and we're transforming social relations, connections, divisions. A lot of these things are being reconfigured around data processes and data-led thinking. Data-led forms of social ordering of different types. So that was kind of motivating me to keep going on the questions of data, because I sort of think that they're kind of at the forefront of how we're organising the social world and understanding it. So the data gaze, as I moved into these sort of questions of you know, the mediation of data circulations as they fall back into the world. One of the questions I thought about is how people can, you know, the power is in the hands of people who speak with those data. I sort of thought that there's a question that there's some obvious questions about visibility there. So I started to think, how could you kind of conceptualize this and understand it? And on a very simple level, the data gaze is about how we see and how we're seen through data. That's kind of what that concept is used to do, is to kind of sensitize us to those processes of what we're seeing with data and how we're seen by them. So it was an attempt really to think through those questions. And I think we'll probably go on to maybe speak a bit more about Foucault later. But one of the things that came up, it was actually I gave a talk, and one of my colleagues, Daryl Martin, sort of said to me, "Oh, it's like Foucault's Birth of the Clinic." And I thought about it, and he was right. So I thought the data gaze emerges out of that observation, really, because what I thought was that the Birth of the Clinic is about the transformation of analytical spaces. In which people were being observed and analysed in clinical spaces for medical reasons. I thought, and Foucault tries to understand the transformation of that, and I thought, well, what I'm trying to understand is the transformation of analytical spaces and forms of knowledge today in the emergence of a data analytics industry of different types. So I sort of took the concept of the gaze from Foucault and found something totally different, but the concept of the gaze was quite helpful in helping, you know, focusing my mind on how we're seen and how we see data.
I'm quite interested in the differences, actually, because, like, yeah, as you say, you know, there's an obvious kind of parallel. You know, it's certainly quite a straightforward relationship, but also there are, you know, kind of moments where you're like, well, actually, we're not going to take everything from the Birth of the Clinic. And I wouldn't go as far as critique of Foucault, but there are kind of moments of difference. And it'd be interesting to see what those moments of difference are.
Yeah, there's quite a few in the book. Because what I end up finding is just something quite, you know, is something quite different to the account of the clinical space and the analytics that Foucault observes in the kind of clinical medical gaze. It's a complete departure, really. I just use Foucault for a bit of inspiration to help me with ideas and give me a bit of analytical sort of focal point that I can use. So what I was able to do with the Foucault text was to actually think about how these spaces were transforming and emerging and all these kinds of things. But to give you a couple of examples of key differences, I mean, one of the things is that the kind of the data gaze is in no way limited to the expert contained within the dedicated analytical clinical space. You know, so you've not got these demarcated analytical spaces like you had with the clinic, and you've not got the same types of demarcation of expertise like the qualified clinician observing and holding the data the medical gaze. The data gaze is something that spreads more widely and goes outside of the hands of the expert, thanks to the kind of prosthetic software analytics, and can be done anywhere at any time. So that allows this gaze to spread outwards into the organizations that we're a part of. It's a kind of decentered gaze that spreads into the social world and can be operated in different ways. So that was one of the key findings. Two of them really about expertise and spaces of analytics. There are quite a few others. I mean, one of the other findings was that the idea that this is a kind of gaze that watches over itself. So it's kind of hyper-surveillant. It watches its subject, but also watches its own structures and practices to make sure that they're as surveillant as possible. Something that the Foucault's medical gaze wasn't set up to do. So they were some of the key differences. There are a number of others that I highlight in the analysis in the book, and where I introduce some other concepts and other ideas that kind of run alongside the data gaze that are kind of outside of the stuff that Foucault tried to do. I mean, one of the things, for example, is that we'll probably go on to speak about, but is the questions around temporality, time, and speed of analytics, which Foucault touches on a little bit in the birth of the clinic. But temporality is not really a prominent part of his analysis, but I think it's much more important in the kind of data analytics, data gaze stuff that I talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like an almost sort of bland or like flippant comment to say, you know, the birth of the clinic is now, what, 50 years old?
Early 1960s, yeah.
Around that time. And, you know, whilst the kind of central theoretical insights are important and have, you know, a longevity, they're really important, like basic social differences. And actually one way of getting to them is probably through that idea, actually, about the idea that things have sped up, that culture is faster, that, you know, time itself has been compressed. Yeah. And it's worth, before we kind of talk, you know, specifically about data imaginaries, data capitalism, before we get into things like infrastructure, maybe hearing a little bit about, I guess, the kind of idea of social or cultural acceleration that comes slightly later in the book, but it'd be useful to hear about that now.
So it's to do with ideas of kind of acceleration as much as with the acceleration itself. I think there's a big push towards kind of the idea of kind of real-time analytics, and that kind of the idea, you know, Mark Andrezovich calls about like immediation, you know, that you can do things in the moment and it gets faster, those kind of until it's immediate. So I tried to tap into some of those debates about like Judy Wiseman being pressed for time, you know, Tomlinson's book on cultures of speed, those acceleration type debates. Because what I'd observed was that a key way in which data analytics spread is through the idea that we need to keep up. So what happens is the idea that the world is speeding up and the idea that data analytics are the way to keep up with the accelerating world are perpetuated and developed by the data analytics industry and the providers of the different software packages and services and stuff like that. So they kind of perpetuate an idea that the world is getting quicker, and they couple that with the idea that the only way to keep up with a sort of increasingly competitive, accelerating, speeding up culture and society and marketplace and everything is for you to become increasingly datafied, data-led, data-informed, and that you need increasingly powerful analytics to be able to compete. Otherwise, you'll be left behind. So there's a kind of fear of being left behind in these accelerating spaces that drives the push towards incorporating data analytics into organizations.
Is this I guess part of the what you describe in the book, this idea of a data imaginary, which seemed to be doing two things in my reading. On the one hand was that, as you described, like disciplining device, you know, if you're not into this, if you're not on top of this, your firm, your government, your individual personality will be left behind.
Yeah.
But at the same time, actually, you know, did some serve some sort of reasonable social functions. You talk about the data imaginary being, what is it, speedy, accessible, revealing, panoramic, prophetic, and smart.
Yeah.
And that sort of like weird hybrid of, you know, sort of discipline and promise was really interesting.
Yeah. So I think in the book I described like the data imaginary is kind of like the diamond tip of the data gaze that kind of cuts through, tears through things. So I was really sort of trying to get to grips with how data-led thinking and data analytics spread so rapidly through the social world and into so many parts of the world, you know, into so many different types of organizations and institutions, trying to get to grips with that. I thought of these as kind of like data frontiers. You know, they're the edges at which data analytics doesn't go beyond, or where data analytics is quite crude. And so the data analytics industry is always looking to push back those data frontiers. And one of the ways you can create ruptures and tear through those sort of barriers is with this data imaginary that projects certain promises and capabilities onto the data and onto data analytics. And they're the types of things. So when I looked across, one of the things I did in a couple of the chapters is to take 34 of these data analytics companies to look at the kind of ideas that they perpetuate around data and data analytics. And you're right, they're the ones I pull out, you know, about being speediness, accessibility, revealing, panoramic, prophetic, smart. these are some of the promises that are attached to the data in order to promote its capabilities and to push back those data frontiers. So this data imaginary is often charged with trying to push back the boundaries and extend the reach of the data gates. This data imaginary facilitates a greater vision for the data gates, allows it to see into different spaces through the kind of promises that it attaches to the data and the analytics.
I mean, later on in the book, you talk about like how these promises, fulfilled is not the right term, but, you know, are sort of operationalized.
Yeah, that's right.
Through this discussion of infrastructures. And yeah. I mean, it was interesting actually because theoretically I was, you know, sort of familiar with a lot of these discussions, but practically you talk about this thing called Hadoop. And how that kind of functions as both a kind of a community on the one hand, but also this infrastructure for delivering data imaginary.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So the book works through these kind of three stages of visions, infrastructures, and practices. And those visions of the data imaginary then feed through into the data infrastructures and shape how they develop, but also how they're understood by the people who are developing them. So they become kind of these sort of horizons that people involved in the creation of data analytics software and infrastructures kind of reach for all the time. These sort of like never quite reach them, but are kind of reaching out for them, you know, all the time to try to get there. Hadoop. What happened was I was doing the initial work where I was looking at the data analytics companies, what I'd noticed was that Hadoop kept coming up. It was the packages, the software packages and services that they provided were often based around Hadoop, which is a kind of software package that is adapted often and reworked in different contexts by these companies. So this project, Hadoop, is a kind of underpinning bit of kit, really, that's used across the data analytics industry. And I thought it's quite interesting this is used so widely, and that a lot of the kind of data infrastructures that we're engaging with and trying to think about in the social sciences and beyond are based upon this software program, this software package project, whatever you call it. They've got different names for it, that is so central. So what I did was I thought I'll follow the object in a way that Lash and Lurie once said. I thought, right, I'll take Hadoop and I will explore what it does and I'll explore what's said about it, but I'll also allow that to open up other bits of software that are connected to Hadoop. So I found, and what I found is that, well, as you described it, really, I found this kind of Hadoop was a kind of central kind of touchstone for a lot of different types of software projects that were all connected together to create these like constellations of devices that are then used within data analytics. And they, as I explore in the chapter, there's all these kind of like ecological kind of terms and ways of imagining this software environment that can be created in and compiled in different ways to do different types of analytics. And you're right, the idea that there's a kind of community of people building this, because it's kind of open source software package that has commercial funders that are based in some of the big tech platforms that we're familiar with. But has a community of, and they emphasize this notion of community of people kind of building it, contributing it, and creating bits of code that are added to it and that kind of thing. So I thought it's quite interesting to try to understand these kind of infrastructural projects that underpin the data processes that we're all exposed to.
And I suppose what's interesting about it is, you know, you're telling a story of, as you described earlier in the book, you know, data capitalism. The sense of like, there's not just kind of, you know, money to be made here, but, you know, there's a reconfiguration of how, you know, particularly sort of businesses, but money-making organizations can function in their relations to the social world. But at the same time, there's like that weird kind of almost sort of old school utopian approach of like, we're just programmers, you know, working as a community. And it's interesting to see those two things, I guess, kind of in tension.
It is,
Do you sort of like, do you get a sense of what's going on, whether, you know, there are, I guess, you know, kind of good things to be, you know, sort of saved from stuff like Hadoop, or, you know, is this unfortunately just it happens to be an open source way, a kind of like a cheap hobbyist form of labor?
There was a couple of things. I mean, one thing I would say is that you can buy t-shirts and vests with Hadoop on. Dave, I'll get you one of them. they've got the merchandise around Hadoop. When I was looking at one of the things that struck me as interesting was the way they organize the open source stuff that they're producing around Hadoop and the Apache Software Foundation that's behind it. People can look that up and see how that operates. One of the things that I found particularly interesting when I was working on that chapter was the way that they organize the work that goes into producing the open source software. And you could see that, I think, that probably tension between the commercial and the open source that you're kind of hinting at there, I think, Dave. And the rules around how the code within Hadoop and these other related bits of software are managed as part of these software projects is interesting, because there's a hierarchy of people involved in that production. Because we can, you know, the idea of open source, think of it as being, you know, it sounds quite sort of flat in its organizational structures, but there was, you know, I think I in the end something like five levels to the hierarchy of people involved in coding that software and producing it. So it's closely protected, that core code, and managed and controlled, you know. And there are the commercial partners as well as those involved in creating it. So just sort of tells you something about what's going on when you can actually see into the organization and management of the production of the software packages that then go into all of these organizations that we come into contact with that are analyzing our data in different ways.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And they're not just organizations though, are they? Like, there are people here as well. And this is the...
That's right,
The sort of final substantive chapter in the book where you talk about... This I found really interesting, actually, the kind of sense of like job roles that aren't really job roles, you know, that... different kind of terms, analysts, engineers, in some ways kind of lay bare, but also conceal different skills and practices that use the data gaze. I mean, it was interesting earlier on, you know, you kind of mentioned expertise. And again, you know, in a open source kind of flat world, there's a sense of like, you know, well, everybody has something to bring, that kind of stuff. But actually, you know, there are really important kind of hierarchies around job titles and who gets to be in charge.
So one of the things that emerges in the data imaginary is the idea that anybody can be their own data analyst. So anybody through the software packages, you know, the idea that they're really intuitive and accessible, You can turn yourself into a data analyst with relatively little knowledge of what's of or qualification. So you can take on the data gaze. You can have your own data gaze simply by buying into these software packages. Now, what that means is, and this is where you get the clash with something like Foucault's idea, is that that then creates questions about expertise in the sector. Because if anybody is able to exercise the data gaze and to analyze data through these software packages, then what's the role of the expert? So that was a kind of one of the questions that's posed by the data imagining that I'll return to when I look at practices. So I look back a little bit historically in response to that and look at the way that data roles are embedded into organizational structures of different types historically, you know, where they emerge from and that kind of thing. Try to think about that a little bit. And what I found interesting there was the way that a division of labor emerges. So you've got this challenge to expertise in data analytics that comes from these kind of like intuitive, you know, the software packages as they're imagined, you know, where anybody becomes a data analyst. How does expertise reassert itself in that situation? So when I looked at the division of labor, and I there's lots of different roles and specialisms that then emerge in response, where expertise is then defended and demarcated using different in different ways, in order to kind of hold out, you know, to differentiate between the amateur and the expert. And what I do in that chapter is identify some of those, that splintering of the division of labor into specialisms as it unfolds, but focusing upon the data analyst and the data engineer in terms of what it is that enables them to demarcate the space of expertise, to demarcate themselves as being the expert. And in the case of the data analyst, it's to do with their ability to cast a kind of eye over the data in a particular way, the kind of expert eye, an expert vision that allows them to see other things, to understand the data, to know when it's clean, to know how to look after it, to know how to make it sanitary, these types of things. Because some of that, the clinical metaphors actually reemerging in that chapter. So I look at that and the kind of expertise around an understanding of data that the data analyst holds onto that can demarcate their expertise. And in the case of the data engineer, it's a detailed understanding of the infrastructures and how the components within data infrastructures can be put into constellations that facilitate certain types of analytical practices or certain insights. So where the amateur data user might be working off a prepackaged bit of software, the data engineer is managing these data flows of these different pipelines of data flows, or they're managing the combination of different versions of Hadoop and these other types of softwares that I talk about, Pig, and they've all got quite interesting names that combine together. So they know how to combine the components of the data infrastructure to optimize the data analytics. That's the idea anyway. So what happens is, what I look at in that chapter is the emergence of like this new division of labor in which expertise is demarcated by those actors in particular ways. So there's these categories of actors emerge. They're able to demarcate their own expertise and to differentiate themselves from the kind of amateur who's working with their prosthetic vision of the software that's being used to analyze the data.
The question that I guess I have about the book, and this is maybe, you know, a little bit provocative, is extent to which this is a problem. There was a strong sense of this is a massive problem. Whereas with the data gaze, I didn't like, you know, I mean, we've alluded to this already, you know, kind of questions about how capitalism works, who makes money, who is in control, crucially, you know, who is allowed to deploy the data gaze. But is it like a problem, you know, is the data, because tyranny of metrics, there was a strong sense in that book about we need to do some resisting. My question is, like, should we be resisting the data gaze, or should we all just be kind of learning how to code?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question, Dave. That is a key difference between these texts. When I wrote Metric Power, I wanted to write something that was about the way that power was being exercised over people and trying to think very political terms about that. Now, I think this book is still political, but in a different way. Because what I thought is with this, I want to show, well, I'll try and show what's going on. I'll try and kind of give these sorts of like glimpses into this massive emergent industry of data analytics, which has largely been neglected despite the fact it's grown to something massive in scale. I'll try to kind of show how it works and how I think these data-led processes are spreading into the organizations and institutions we're a part of, how they work, how the infrastructures are built, the types of practices that are going on, the sorts of promises, you know, try and kind of like really lay those out. And in this, in the data gaze, I still try to put the presence of a kind of data-informed, data-led capitalism and way of thinking at the center of the book in the same way as I did with Metric Power. But the politics is a bit more woven into it, I think, in this particular text. I didn't want to present it as starkly as I'd done in Metric Power. And I wanted to lay it out so that people could make their mind up about whether or not they want to resist. And if they do want to, then there might be some clues in by unraveling what's going on. There might be some clues in how to do it and how to present it. I mean, one of the obvious things is if you look at the data imaginary and its promises, if that's the way in which data analytics spread, then there's an opportunity there to counter those ideas about the world that are being presented and attached as promises, because they're not necessarily realities. They're ways of thinking about data. They're ways of seeing the world that can then be countered by people if they want to resist. And understanding similarly where the infrastructures come from means that you can understand how capitalism is woven into the spaces that we occupy and the roles of people involved. You know, once you sort of understand those practices, you can perhaps get a better grip on how you might respond. So I would agree. And this was written, and I suppose this is what, you know, the Foucault inspiration perhaps played out a little bit as well, because Foucault's text is a bit like that, I think, too. I was laying it out in a way that would facilitate people thinking about whether or how they might resist. And it might be that in some ways this is more instructional about what you might do in response than Metric Power. Whether it's a problem or not, I think it can be damaging, and I think it can be harmful, and I think it can be violent in different ways. But I wanted to be a bit more ambivalent, because I wanted to engage in a dialogue with people that might think that there are potentially progressive ways of deploying the data gaze. And I didn't want to be closed off from those kinds of dialogues and debates, because I think it's quite, in a way, it's compelling to be drawn towards a dismissive engagement with the politics of data. And I just wanted to lay things out a bit more here to open up dialogue with people that might see it from different perspectives. And I wanted the subversiveness to be woven into the text a little bit more in this occasion. I don't know if that actually makes sense, but that's kind of what I was intending anyway. I often think about these, I think you might know this, Dave, but I often think about these things in terms of music. And this is the equivalent of, you know, the second verse of Come On Eileen or something. It's like a subversive politics kind of hidden in something that's hopefully a bit more glossy.
And in the spirit of a kind of, you know, speeded up, compressed time,
yeah.
What's the next project? I mean, is there a, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide style trilogy, four parts, another data book, or to an extent the three books, yeah. In some ways,
yeah,
you've settled the accounts, I guess,
yeah.
Here's what's gone on in the media space, here's a political critique,
yeah,
and here's, you know, almost kind of an STS, follow the object style reading, what's left to do, or is it time for something completely different?
Yeah, probably time for some. I think there'll be some related things. I feel like I've said what I can at the moment. But, you know, sometimes it'll be like a few months down the line, you think, oh, there is something else to say about that, you know. So what happened once I submitted the data gates, I just went and returned to a book I was writing about George Zimmel. Just something totally different, really. I mean, on the surface, totally different, but actually related in the way that they're in the type of social science, I think. So which I completed, called George Zimmel's Concluding Thoughts, which is about the last 4 years of Zimmel's life and his writings during that period. And I worked on a short book for Emerald called The Quirks of Digital Culture, which is going to be out later this year as well. And that's a short book that tries to do something quite different with some of the ideas that I'd worked on over previous years. And then that's kind of a moment to pause, really. So I'm hoping to. I've got a little bit of a plan for something that that might touch on a few of the kind of technological developments that we're seeing unfolding and that will unfold over the next 3 years. So my plan is perhaps to take 2 or 3 years now and just try to write something about those. So they'll touch on data, but I think probably going in a bit of a different direction.